I'm John Kroll. It's Election Day, and on No Limits today, we're going to talk about one of the results of elections past, the implications of having a state legislature in which one party has supermajorities in both chambers. We'll talk about what this means for the political process and what it means for the tone of the political dialogue. My guests are three people who know Indiana government and politics well. Kevin Brenniger of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute and Indiana Week in Review, and Julia Vaughn of Common Cause Indiana. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits at WFYI.org. Facebook is nolimits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about, and it's an Election Day show, about Hoosier governance under supermajorities in the legislature. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are three folks who probably, between them, know Indiana government about as well as anyone, starting with John Ketzenberger, who's the president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. John, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. Kevin Brenniger, who's the president and CEO of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
And Julia Vaughn, who's the policy director for Common Cause Indiana. Julia, welcome back.
Thanks for having
me. You're
the
sole veteran here.
I'm happy to have that status.
And the I should say that the kind of the premise of this show and what prompted it is a conversation I had with Senator Richard Lugar a few years ago when he was talking about the health care debate. And really, he said part of what really ratcheted up the hard feelings was that at that time, Democrats had such strong majorities in Congress at the federal level that they didn't feel like they had to negotiate. And then that increased the frustration on the minority side, kind of increased the arrogance on the majority side, and created a dynamic that was hard to control. We've now seen some very bitter battles here in Indiana, too, in the time since then, where we've also had supermajorities in which Republicans are controlling. So I wanted to talk just about, without making this partisan, whether that dynamic creates different kinds of challenges for us as a state and as a country than more divided government would. And that's sort of the starting point for the conversation. John, I'm going to let you share your thoughts first and then...
Okay. Well, I think that one-party rule is it is what it is. When you get to a supermajority status, I think that's when you run the risk of, and honestly, if I were the leader of a supermajority caucus, I don't think that would be much fun because you're trying to herd cats with separate interests at that point, and it's hard to maintain an agenda and enough discipline within your caucus to pass that agenda, whatever it may be, and presumably it got you elected. But I think it's healthy when you have divided government. I think you have a much better debate. I think you have less chance for corruption because you have a stronger check and balance on one side or the other. And so I am not as comfortable when you have a supermajority, and particularly when you have one on both sides of the House, and that's not to, or both sides of the state house. That's not to cast aspersions on any of the leaders in the Indiana General Assembly, but I do think that it's a difficult thing to manage, one. And two, I think it's not in the public's interest because you don't have the breadth of views that are probably more representative in the population at large.
Well, and Kevin, there is that theory. I'm going to let you respond, obviously, to the premise, but John has introduced an element here where there is a line of thinking that says that when you have supermajorities like these, the loyal opposition begins to emerge within your own caucus to some degree because they start splitting into factions. So with that note in mind.
That when you get such a large majority, there is a herding cats element. I can remember in the mid to late 1980s when I was the tax and fiscal policy analyst for the Senate Republicans, there were 4 years where they only had a 26-24 majority, not the 37 that they have today, and maybe even more than that tomorrow after this election. And kind of the saying back then was, boys and girls, we're either going to hang together or we're going to hang separately, because if we were going to do something as a caucus and as a party, you know, to move an agenda or a piece of legislation forward, no one could, quote, flake off and not vote with the caucus. So, but I think supermajorities are kind of in the eyes of the beholder. Depends on whether it's a supermajority of folks you agree with or your party or you're somehow affiliated with or not. I don't think they're inherently bad things, but certainly different dynamics are created. I would suggest that the reason that the Democrats in Indiana in the House are in a super minority is because they, in the eyes of the voters, abused the power and went to Illinois for 6 weeks and went from a minority to a super minority because voters backlashed against them not being there doing their work and objecting to the bills that were being brought forth on the floor of the House rather than doing it in press conferences held over in a motel in Illinois.
Julia, what concerns would, say, Common Cause have about supermajorities?
I think the one-party rule and particularly the supermajorities are leading to some extreme public policies and simply bad government. I mean, the situation with Eric Turner, where he killed a bill privately in caucus, and what happens in caucus stays in caucus. The rules didn't cover that. He was unable to be disciplined, even though the majority of people, even inside the legislature, think he behaved badly and unethically. So I think it's not just the public policy piece, which we've seen has brought us some extreme issues rising to the top of the legislative agenda, but I think that public integrity is really threatened when you've got these large supermajorities who are really doing the public's business behind closed doors in caucus.
We are talking about the effect of supermajorities on Indiana governance here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. David, welcome to the program.
Hey, welcome, gentlemen and ladies. Good afternoon. I just had my question is, how do we communicate with a supermajority that pretty much is bent on enacting their own policies without the input of other people? We'll be heard, but we won't necessarily be heeded, as you may say. And the one comment about that is that usually generates a situation where the turnaround happens 4 years from now. People who were not heard will be out voting and making sure that that majority doesn't happen again. But that's my question. How do we communicate with that supermajority concerning what we, other people who don't have the same views, would like to do?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, David. Julia, I'm going to let you take that one first.
Well, I think you need to be persistent. You need to think about your message very carefully and tailor it to resonate to the folks who are in charge. But I think we also need to work on reducing the numbers in the supermajority, and the way we're going to do that is through redistricting reform.
I intended to get to that at some point. I mean, the whole question
well,
of gerrymandering.
Well, I'm just going to jump right on
that's
in.
Okay. It's,
because,
it's
you know,
we'll
Kevin's assertion that the yeah. House supermajority is solely attributable to the Democrats' action. Well, it's certainly that's part of it, but I think a bigger piece of this is the outstanding gerrymandering job that was done by Republicans in both the House and Senate in 2011. You know, the reason why we're having a really ho-hum election today is because of the lack of competitive races at the congressional and state legislative level, and that is absolutely a condition of gerrymandering. Yeah, those districts were drawn by the majority to keep their majority.
To put it in some context, if I recall the numbers correctly, slightly more, between 53% and 54% of Hoosier voters in 2012 voted for Republican candidates in the Indiana House, and somehow that resulted in 69 seats for Republicans. John,
you got to remember though that the opposite works. The reason that the Democrats were able to hold the House in Indiana for so many of the 20 years before that was that they had control
creative
of the maps.
Map drawing.
And
absolutely.
They were able to do that. And the Republican argument at the time was there are 54% who vote Republican, yet they only had, you know, 48 seats or 47 seats at the time.
Back at that time, it was actually about 57 to 57% of the votes cast
were for Republicans. And so gerrymandering works both ways. I do agree, however, that it's not an optimal situation. You know, there are federal laws that are come into play for some parts of the state when it comes to drawing districts. But I would really appreciate and enjoy and find interesting a more compact, more population-based map for the state of Indiana, for both the House and the Senate. And while the assumption might be that it would break Republican because of the majority of people who cast Republican ballots in Indiana, I think legislative races are personal enough that you would have a variety of candidates, and it would strengthen increase the number of views and strengthen those held by the individual candidates in these individual districts, and it would decentralize the power of the in the legislature of the caucuses themselves.
Well, and does it also – yeah, Kevin, go ahead, and then I'll raise my point afterwards.
I was just saying – this will be my 34th session coming up working in and around the
I don't
state
know whether
house.
To congratulate you or offer condolences on
well,
that.
You know,
but.
When I used to serve on the school board in Noblesville where I live, I'd tell people I didn't take up enough of a beating during the day at the state house, and so I'd go home at night and serve on the school board. But my observation over that long period of time is that supermajorities tend not to exist for very long.
Right.
And, you know, the electorate takes care of that. You get the splintering off that was talked about. Mm-hmm. But to the gentleman's question, I think, you know, there are vehicles to communicate to members of the general assembly, both your own representatives and others, through mail, through phone, through email, and that if issues are pursued that are not mainstream or in the interest of people, then, you know, that's why we have elections, and elections have consequences. And you know, the minority stands up and makes their objections and then makes their case to the voters in the next election.
We've gotten a comment from a listener named Michael on Facebook, and if you'd like to reach out to us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Says, unfortunately, the Republican agenda of not funding adequate education has worked well for them. Sadly, what we have now is an ignorant citizenry and a corrupt corporate-owned legislature. Well, I think we know where Michael is probably voting based on that comment. But, you know, I think his point here, and to some degree David's, was about how responsive government is when supermajorities. And once again, Julia, you're the one nodding your head, so I'm going to call on you. Is divided government more responsive or supermajorities? or is it a question of who they're responsive to?
Well, I think it's a question of who they're responsive to. I mean, you know, there's the whole campaign finance question here as well. You know, my sarcastic response to the earlier caller would have been to create yourself a PAC, and you suddenly might become much more listened to inside the State House. But, you know, it's a complicated question, but certainly we're seeing a tendency to not listen so much to the grassroots when we have these large majorities of one party controlling everything that goes on at the State House.
Kevin, you want to respond to that as well?
Well, I would just say that I think it cuts both ways. There are things that in a supermajority situation, there are things that get done that maybe get beyond sort of where mainstream voters are. But at the same time, split parties is causing nothing to get done in Washington, D.C., and the U.S. Senate can't even pass a budget in 5 years, which is its one constitutional duty. So it really does cut both ways.
We are talking about Hoosier governance under a supermajority here on No Limits. My guests are John Ketzenberger, Julia Vaughn, and Kevin Brenniger. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today on Election Day about the implications of Hoosier governance under supermajorities in both the Indiana House of Representatives and the Indiana Senate. My guests are John Ketzenberger, who's the president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, Julia Vaughn, who's the policy director of Common Cause Indiana, and Kevin Brenniger, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. Well, we were just talking here about, you know, one of the other effects that we haven't had a chance to explore, which is that it tends to drive both parties to the extremes because candidates begin to worry about challenges from a primary challenge. Yeah. In fact, you know, one of the developments over the past 10 years is that primary somehow became a verb somewhere along the way. People got worried about being primaried. Kevin, you want to talk about that?
Well, about a year ago, August, the Wall Street Journal did an analysis of congressional seats in the U.S. House of Representatives and said that roughly 10 years ago, 40% of the seats, the districts across the country, were swing districts where either party had a reasonable chance of winning those. Today, that number has been reduced to 15% or less, and it means that if I'm a Republican incumbent, I'm more worried about being challenged in the primary from someone farther to the right, and if I'm a Democrat incumbent, I'm more worried about being challenged by somebody farther to the left. And so you end up with folks that are in Republican districts that are more to the right and Democrat districts more to the left. And the there's very few moderates left and people who are willing to come together and compromise and solve problems because folks view it as if I'm an incumbent and I'm trying to compromise and maybe vote for, you know, a less extreme solution, then I may end up facing a primary opponent, and it leads to gridlock.
Yeah.
Well, another problem with that is that then you have self-preservation as a primary motivation
rather
for
than crafting public policy. Yeah.
Yeah, and
serving your constituents.
Exactly, yeah. And or maybe attracting constituents that you normally wouldn't. You know, when you have that kind of a view that's out of the mainstream, and I think that when you have that divergence, you limit the amount of diversity of thought. And when you do that, then your solutions, whatever they may be, are less worthy and less sustainable than they might have been before. Because if you do come to that point where a compromise is possible, you're not talking about big moves. You're talking about incremental moves. And we're talking about some serious problems both at the federal and state level. That requires some thought way outside the parameters that are currently available with these legislatures and Congress.
Well, and Julia, recently on this program, we had long interviews with both Richard Lugar and Evan Bayh, who were saying at the federal level that the dynamics that Kevin and John both were talking about have, in addition to making compromise difficult, really disproportionately increased the influence of single-issue groups or
right.
single-issue PACs. Are we seeing that at the state level as well?
Well, I think so. And, you know, we've got a wide-open campaign finance and lobbying system that, you know, lets them have their way electorally, and they can certainly throw their weight around lobbying once the session starts. And, you know, I think it's leading to more extreme legislators and this feeling from voters that we're electing people who really don't represent us. You know, the majority of Hoosiers are very moderate people. And so when we look at these extreme conservatives that are getting elected out of lopsided districts, I think it causes a lot of disenchantment, just a lack of recognition that these people are really representing me and my interests. So it's another reason we've got to make some fundamental reforms to the way districts are drawn and how we elect people out of them.
Does it chase otherwise the kind of people in theory we would want representing us away from the process, John Katzenberger?
I think there are a lot of candidates who are worthy who, upon further reflection, think, why do I want to do that to myself or my family, and choose not to. And I think that's one of the primary reasons for that. But I think it also chases voters out of the process, mm-hmm. John. I think, you know, we're looking at anticipated vote totals that are very, very low today. And there are a lot of reasons for that. There aren't many high-profile races around the state or in individual districts. But I think one of the primary reasons is that people think that their vote is not, you know, on par with some other votes. And so why even bother with the process? And when you have that kind of thinking going on, you've got a real problem, and we need to address that.
We are talking about the effect that supermajorities to some degree, lopsided government has on Hoosier governance here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Marianne, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. I sound like a broken record, but I'm calling because I voted this morning in District 44. And I knew this was coming, but it's just so disheartening because, like, our state representative, there was no Democrat running against him. So, you know, we go there, all you can do is vote for him. And if we at least had a thing that I'm voting for you, but I don't have any confidence in you, you know, that at least they would know how many of us voted for him. And, you know, he hasn't answered any of my letters. So, you know, it's like they really, this is a desperate situation. I mean, I drove home feeling like I live in a one-party system because I had no choice of who to vote for our state representative. And that's pretty scary. And I know locally what he stands for. He stands for Big Ag. He stands for, you know, total against any kind of health care. He's not helped us up, but watch more land be destroyed here, you know, so we really don't have a voice, and it really is serious and frightening.
Well,
and, you know, it makes you not want to vote at all. I mean, and we wonder why we don't have people voting, but when I go and vote for a state representative, I vote for him or nobody.
Thanks very much for the call. I'm going to let John Katzenberger respond to that, because that was sort of your point, actually.
Yeah.
It's very disheartening to voters.
Well, clearly you can hear from her response that she's disheartened by that process. And what you've got is, and I don't have the districts by number in my head, so I'm not sure which one is
you
44.
You have a life, right?
You know, there are a lot of districts, and actually there are a lot of Democrat districts where you don't have Republicans run because mm-hmm. of the numbers. And so, you know, it's just viewed by the opposition as something that's not winnable. So we'll put our resources into that handful of districts where we think there could be, where we could make a difference. And that's where the resources are spent and the energy is done. And So you have swaths of the state that are without a choice.
One of the things that Marianne said, asked for, was even, could there be an option where I get to vote no confidence of some sort here, if that's the case? Now, I also want to deal with the question to some degree. When I hear that, I think, okay, yeah, to some degree we can blame it. That also does strike me as a bit of an abdication of responsibility on the part of the parties, too. I mean, even if it's not a likely win, you should present an alternative. Julia?
Well, and why do we only have, you know, a couple of party options here? Mm-hmm. Because the two major political parties have passed laws to make it very difficult for anybody other than the Libertarians to qualify for ballot access. Yes, and it was a decade-long battle for them. So, you know, simply being friendlier, there are other third parties out there that are active in other states where, you know, if you didn't get a Republican or a Democrat challenger, perhaps there could be a third-party challenger. So stronger third parties could potentially help this issue. But really, redistricting reform is the 800-pound gorilla that we need to bring some more competition. And that's key. You know, it's the who. We need an independent entity, not the legislature drawing the maps. But they need a directive in state statute to maximize the number of competitive districts. There are a handful of states who do redistricting that way, and they're enjoying more competition this election day than we are here in Indiana.
Kevin.
I would just ask, what's your model for establishing that commission?
We would like to take a hybrid of Iowa and California. In Iowa, they have for several decades allowed their legislative services agency to draw the maps under some pretty strict statutory criteria. We'd like to see that merge with the California process, which puts citizens in charge of their process.
How are the citizens chosen?
They are chosen by three members of the Bureau of State Audits, a Republican, a Democrat, and an Independent. It's a complicated process, but it's a beautiful process because it does manage to insulate this extremely political process from politics as much as possible.
I would submit that as long as you have people within the state serving on these commissions, regardless of how they're chosen,
it'll become politicized eventually.
Those people or the people that appoint them have an agenda, and the only way you can get true independence is if you were to go as far as to have people from outside of the state serving on your redistricting commission.
But they don't know Indiana, so this is a job for Hoosiers. There are ways to insulate this process from politics in California.
I'd invite you to participate in the debate
during the General Assembly next year.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's exactly why you would choose people from out of state, because they don't know Indiana. They would just follow the guidelines of population targets and compactness of districts.
The Legislative Services Agency can do that quite capably with direction from a group of citizens that are representative of Indiana voters.
The Legislative Services Agency is hired and appointed by the legislators. So
we are going to resolve that within this studio. We're talking about the effect of supermajorities on Hoosier governance. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Gregory, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I was concerned about the fact that I would imagine there's a statistical significance tied to the amount of money that is generated by these political campaigns, and it would appear to me that the guy that tends to raise the most capital tends to win the most elections. And I wondered, what if at the state, federal, and local level we had an electoral process that was publicly funded and that the campaign season only lasted, say, 30 to 60 days? It is my contention that the person that brought forth the most effective voter education program and appealed to the broadest section of voters would be the victor in these campaigns. And it didn't make any difference how many people were running for that office or not.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Kevin, I'm going to let you take that one first.
Gee, thanks, John.
He was sort of swinging it right into Julia's wheelhouse, though.
I'm thinking about, I don't know how you limit the election season, because you know I can declare I'm running for an office tomorrow, the day after the election, for an election 2 years or 4 years
from
now.
Yeah, you can declare your candidacy for the...
Yeah, that's my constitutional right.
2032 presidential election, if you want to.
I'm not sure what you do about that. And I don't have a strong opinion, but I would say our organization doesn't support public funding of elections.
Julia.
Public financing has worked well in states like Maine and Arizona to make it possible for a more diverse array of candidates to run for political office, and it's gotten high marks from the candidates themselves and the public alike about the fresh ideas it's brought to political campaigns. So I certainly think there's merit to public financing. Limiting the timing of political campaigns is something that's common in Europe, but I think Kevin's right. There's certainly some First Amendment issues, but it's one of the most common suggestions that I hear from the public. Can't we just limit this to 6 weeks? You know, I'm sick of this by week two, but, you know, we could stand it for 6 weeks. It's these, you know, year-round campaigns that just really make people tired by the end.
John.
Imagine being in North Carolina today where $108 million has been spent by the campaigns for the Senate there, and they've been exercising their free speech rights as outlined by the Supreme Court's decisions four years ago. And they're probably looking toward the end of the campaign with amazing relief because they've been inundated with all of these messages, but I agree that you can't really regulate the amount of time involved in a campaign, and regulating money is difficult in this current atmosphere for a couple of reasons. First, you know, the Supreme Court and Citizens United equated money with First Amendment rights and said that you have to be careful if you're going to place any limits on that. And the way to do that then would be legislatively. And there's no appetite among the incumbent legislators, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, to limit the amount of money that flows into their campaigns and their caucuses, because that's their wherewithal for gaining and keeping power. So, you know, money is as big an issue in all of this as gerrymandering is, and it's probably even more difficult to control for the reasons I just mentioned. So it's, you know, we're really talking about some pretty intractable, potentially intractable circumstances here.
I would add, if I could,
go ahead, Kevin.
The gentleman's point that we've actually, with the Citizens United decision, begun an era where the candidate who raises the most money on their own may not be the one who spends the most or who wins, because now outside entities can choose to get behind a candidate, spend money independently from the candidates themselves, and have a great impact on the outcome of
elections. Well, we also had the example here in the state of Glenda Ritz winning, you know, in a race against a far more heavily funded opponent, in part because she was able to leverage some organizational resources and also social media.
Tap into grassroots frustration about, you know, local education issues as well.
And that was a social media-driven campaign, which was is becoming more and more prevalent, but was cutting edge at that time.
I've gotten an email from a listener named John who says, simple, all districts must be composed of four straight lines except where those districts are on the state borders. Make sense, John?
Well, it makes sense on its face. It's not technically possible for every district across the state because of federal requirements about minority, majority representation, those kinds of things. But, you know, I go back to, I forget how long ago it's been, but it's been several years now. And the city-county races, the city-county council races were drawn by the courts, and those have turned three times. The majority has turned three times since that happened. Those are fairly compact districts.
We are talking about Hoosier governance under a supermajority. My guests are John Ketzenberger, Julia Vaughn, and Kevin Brenniger. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about Hoosier governance under a supermajority. My guests are John Ketzenberger, who's the president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, Julia Vaughn, who's the policy director of Common Cause Indiana, and Kevin Brenniger, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking the call. I'm curious if your panel would comment on what I've heard referred to as the non-political primary system. I think California is doing this, and the way it's set up is that anybody who wants to run for a seat gets on the primary ballot, and it's all on one ballot. There's not a Democratic primary. There's not a Republican primary. It's just all on one ballot. And then the top two or three vote-getters out of the primary go to the general election. And it's, it sounds like it sort of takes the politicization out of the redistricting a bit. But I'm just curious if you guys have any comment on that. I'll take the answer offline.
Thanks very much for the call, Tom. Julia, I'll start with you.
Well, I think, you know, it's the two major parties are extremely strong here in Indiana, so I wouldn't see any movement towards that. But I think that non-politicizing elections or taking partisanship out of elections is certainly something that's friendly to voters. Most of us aren't hardline. We see ourselves as more independent, and so I think it's restrictive to divide ourselves in May between Republicans and Democrats, and it leads a lot of people wanting more.
One of the things I've noticed, I'm going to throw this, let both Kevin and John and Julia, if you want to, take a crack at it, though, is that at the same time that the political jousting within the process has become seemingly more partisan, the idea of partisan labels has itself become more unpopular. If you look at all of the campaign ads right now and the signs, most of the candidates aren't saying, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat. They're, you know, it's always so-and-so, a Hoosier voice or something like that.
Right.
Which means, and some of that I get. I mean, if you look at the public approval ratings for both parties, I mean, they're just slightly above the common cold. Right,
I'm beginning
now,
to wonder who the public likes, actually, because the public doesn't seem to like anyone these days.
That's a good point.
You know, yeah. I think that when you're talking about identification with political parties, it becomes very important for the candidates when they are seeking funds. And, you know, that's a two-way street. The campaigns have to bring money to the affair in order to get money then from the parties themselves. But the parties, and then to a slightly lesser extent, but a great extent, the caucuses, so the House Republicans, the House Democrats, and so on, are really the place where money is kept and then redistributed. And that's where the power in the money is. And so the candidates have to be responsive to that, and I think the parties have perceived we don't need to use the label necessarily to win our perspective, but we go out and use this money to recruit candidates and then to spend that money on a message, and it's around that individual candidate. There is an ad that's running currently in a district that's southwest of Marion County for state representative. It's Representative Ubelhor versus Jeff Sparks, and both sides have come out firing in this race. And in the Ubelhor ad, which suggests that Mr. Sparks doesn't know anything and is not telling the truth, it's not identified as his ad except for a very small message at the bottom that's required by law. Otherwise, you wouldn't know who was saying this about that candidate. So I think that, you know, that goes to the point that was made earlier about, you know, your point about disassociating and the nature of the campaigns.
What does that do to the parties, though, Kevin? I mean, you know, because it strikes me that there's almost a schizophrenic approach here. Sometimes we're members of a party and sometimes we're not.
Well, certainly there's been a trend towards mm-hmm. greater independence and less party affiliation among voters. And I'd like to think that some of that is voters becoming more discerning. And I observe and believe that while there are some districts that are so overwhelmingly Republican or Democrat that the other side can't win, but there are many, many districts that can be won by someone from either party, and that quality of the candidates ultimately matters significantly and maybe is the most important thing.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Colleen, and if you would like to reach out to us via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. She says, it seems to me that a supermajority leads to a certain amount of arrogance. Example, Governor Pence has substantially constrained the action of the state superintendent of public instruction, Ritz. Ritz received more votes than the governor, but he has been able to invalidate the lawful votes cast by the citizens of Indiana. What arrogance. I am not a member of ISTA or any other PAC, but I am genuinely concerned about the attempted destruction of the public school system. And in that particular public policy debate, that is now a familiar refrain. This isn't something we voted for. Julia.
Well, and I think it really gets to the frustration that people feel when they see issues break down at the local level. There are so many school districts having all kinds of problems, and the state's not helping. And in fact, many people believe the state's actually hurting local school systems. So I think she's right. There is a lack of responsiveness that you get when you have overwhelming numbers controlling everything in state government. And it will be interesting to see. I know that in the few competitive state legislative races out there, education is one of the top issues. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out in how people vote and who wins and who loses.
We've gotten an email also. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I would just say that the issues with respect to education leadership in our state and the superintendent and the State Board of Education, the governor, have nothing to do with supermajorities in the legislature. They have everything to do with the fact that we have two office holders viewed as having responsibility for education policy in the state, in mm-hmm. the superintendent and the governor. And the simple and direct solution to that is a position that our organization has held for many, many decades and has advocated for when pieces of legislation have come up to do this in the past, and that's make the superintendent of public instruction an appointed position just like every other head of every other department in state government is, and just like the vast majority of states have the structure of the head of the Department of Education is a gubernatorial appointee.
And that, you know, has been something that both parties have embraced at one time or another.
Yes.
over the years, too.
But not brought to fruition.
And incidentally, the Republicans held a majority on both sides that could have made this happen under a Republican governor, mm-hmm. and they chose not to press it. And then Glenda Ritz was elected, and then this whole episode has unfolded. So, you know, I think it's interesting, Kevin. You raise a good point, and one that I think is widely held. But the reality is that it didn't get done, and so now you've got essentially two boards of education operating in the state, and a lot of confusion about really who does direct the policy. And so there is the confusion that Julia talked about around the policy. There's no one policy. There are several policies as a result.
And folks working at odds with one another.
And so the primary purpose is to stop the other side, as opposed to enact a policy that is proactive in trying to attack a problem
and carry out the work directed by the statutes that the legislature has passed.
We've gotten an email from our regular listener, Jerry, who says, I've always been puzzled about the pride some Hoosiers take in having a citizen legislature. That is, a legislature whose members are not paid a decent salary for their services. One implication of this situation is that only people who can afford to serve are beholden to someone besides the electorate for their living. I humbly suggest that this inherently raises a number of conflict of interest issues. Those who are independently wealthy or whose employers willingly allow them significant leave from their jobs can hardly be thought to be genuinely representative of the citizenry as a whole. Perhaps this explains why there are so many more doctors, lawyers, and farmers, agribusiness people in the legislature than fast food workers or retail salespeople. I'd like to hear your panelists comment on this fundamental paradox. Wouldn't the people be better served by individuals who actually work for the people? John, I'm going to start with you on that one.
You know, I've over time, when watching the legislature, toyed with the idea myself of what would it be like if there was a full-time legislature and they were fully staffed, and what difference would that make? And I just think culturally, Indiana is not going to embrace that kind of a legislature. And I've ultimately come to the idea that it would just shift the power in different ways. So I guess I disagree with Jerry's main point, but I do think that there are things that could be done to improve the system. And I would note that it's not an insignificant amount of money that these folks are working for. It's not their primary income, but it has been raised significantly over the last 10 years. Having that as a job is not, it pays much better than it used to.
Well, but I guess that also brings us back around to the whole Eric Turner thing, too. I mean, the whole idea that
I think there are better ways to deal with the conflicts of interest that are so prevalent in the General Assembly without going to a full-time legislature. It's an idea that isn't very popular, but I don't think it's the only solution. We need to recognize conflicts of interest. Individual legislators should be able to call out other legislators on their conflicts. There's a certain amount of self-policing that has to happen inside the General Assembly because our Constitution requires each level of government to police itself. So ethics reform, the one good thing about the Turner scandal is it has made the legislative leadership admit that the rules are too weak and they've pledged to come back and pass some reform. So far, they're only talking about transparency and disclosure. They really need to get to the enforcement piece because without that, the system protects corrupt legislators. It doesn't protect the public interest.
Well, should there be, at the very least, transparency and disclosure are bigger steps than we've seen in the past. I mean, as I think somebody said, probably Julia, I think the whole, what stays in caucus, what happens in caucus stays in caucus, makes you wonder exactly when Las Vegas became the moral exemplar we should follow here. But
fitting, isn't it?
But, is that idea that when you have a supermajority, when really all the votes you need to get something done, should there be heightened standards of transparency and disclosure about what gets discussed? Maybe not who said what, but what gets discussed, all of that. John.
Well, you have to have faith that what's being done behind closed doors is being done on the up and up. Mm-hmm. And they've seriously affected that with this episode. And they're seeking to restore that by the measures that Julia has discussed and others that may come up during the process. But I think that you do. I think a more formalized, because you will have conflicts. They are inherent, but they need to be recognized and acknowledged. And if done so, then I think that helps restore faith in the process and makes people more confident that the decisions that were being made are made on a policy basis rather than a personal interest basis. And, I think in fairness, I have to point out that, this situation with Representative Turner was allowed to occur until they realized the effect that it had, the enormous amount of money that he stood to gain from this. Mm-hmm. And that's when the caucus got upset and when members of the caucus started talking with some members of the press to bring this to light and made that all come out into the public realm.
But we can take it the discussion away to some degree from the personal involvement in terms of disclosure. You know, there's a fairly contested race here in Indianapolis with State Senator Mike Delf, who had a fight dispute with other members of his caucus during the legislative session over Twitter and in a lot of other ways that we don't need to go into. But one of his points really was his contention was that a debate about a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage or civil unions in Indiana should not have the debate that mattered should not have taken place behind closed doors. And to some degree, that seemed to be a product of the supermajority as well, Julia.
And he's absolutely right. The public's business should be discussed in public.
Okay. Kevin.
I'll just double back on a couple of things. One,
sure.
The gentleman's question about full-time or part-time legislature. If we go to full-time legislature, then the full-time job of those legislators will be to get reelected.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see that as a good thing. Plus, by having a citizen legislature, you draw from people who have other work experiences that they can bring to the table. With regard to Eric Turner, despite everything that's been said, the one thing that he did do that most legislators rarely do is he did recuse himself from voting in committee and on the floor. And, you know, you've got this gray area when you've got a citizen legislator who things that vote on that do impact them, maybe not as directly or as much as was involved here, but legislators vote on things all the time that could be identified or perceived as being in their interest. Teachers voting on state budgets,
but legislators,
for examples. And so he did do that. And that's different there's maybe once or twice a session that a legislator recuses themselves and doesn't vote on an issue. And the other thing I'd say about the marriage amendment is it was fully debated on the floor of the House.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think what Delf would have argued, though, is that it's a constitutional amendment. It had been passed through both chambers once. The Senate deserved that opportunity. I'm not sure. We're running out of time here right now, and I'm not sure we resolved anything. But I've got to say, I really enjoyed talking with all of you and hearing your thoughts. I find this whole subject to be fascinating. So I'd like to thank my guest, Kevin Brenniger. Kevin, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
John
Appreciate
Katzenberger.
Enjoyed it. Thank
Good
you,
to have you here. And Julia Vaughn.
Thanks, John.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
I'd also like to thank all of our listeners. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of your questions, but I think we may be talking about this again. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.